This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and we're spending time and the opportunity to talk, at least a first conversation, with some of the people who in Northwest Indiana have expressed interest in wanting to run for public office, and in particular to succeed the soon-to-be-retiring Congressman Pete Visglowski. Congressman Visglowski has been a long-time Northwest Indiana representative for us in Congress. He's decided not to run for re-election, and a number of people have jumped in and said they are interested in running. One of them who is interested and will soon be officially filing to be on the ballot in the November, I should say in the May Democratic Party primary election, and hopefully in November as well, too, is Sabrina Hake, and she's in the studio with us today. Sabrina, thank you for joining us here at Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, tell us first a little bit about yourself, about the interest that you have in general in Northwest Indiana in particular, and what got you more involved in wanting to be involved with the issues that the first congressional district poses.
Thank you. The first part of that is telling you a little bit about myself, so I'm happy to do that. I'm a fifth-generation Hoosier. My parents' 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 parents emigrated from Germany to southern Indiana in the mid-1800s and got involved with a family business there, which was the local newspaper. Then I went to school in southern Indiana at University of Southern Indiana in Evansville, and then went to law school at what we called IUPUI at the time, mm-hmm. In Indianapolis. So that is my long-standing Indiana connection. I was actually born in California because my dad was in the Navy, but then we came back to southern Indiana pretty quickly when I was young, and that's my long-standing Hoosier connection. My interest in running for Congress. Really, I am afraid that if we don't address climate change immediately and on an emergency basis, it's going to be too late. I think our window of opportunity is closing, and I think everybody is now aware of the fact that we need to start making changes. We can all see the fires. We can all see the extreme temperatures and what they're causing to our storm system. We see erosion even here in Lake Michigan along the coast, in Portage, and in Gary, and it's alarming. And people want to do something about it, including me, and I'd like to lead that fight. And I also think that it's going to be the best thing that we've seen for our regional economy in generations.
You're involved, I understand, with a private law practice. You're based in Chicago with a practice, but you do a lot of work here in Northwest Indiana as well, I understand. Has it been working with clients and other people in the Chicago area, besides personal interest in the environmental issues and the other issues in the region that got you interested in running for Congress?
Well, my work in Chicago, first of all, I practice in Chicago. I don't practice in Indiana. Mm-hmm. I've been working for a number of private clients. And the Board of Education of the City of Chicago has been my longstanding client. And so I get involved with a lot of educational issues. I'm primarily a litigation lawyer, which means I do more court work than I don't do tax work or criminal law or family law or anything like that.
Right.
And yes, my interest has always been in trying to help people in their everyday lives. I certainly in education, it affects everybody. It affects everything, whether you have children in school or not. So it's one of the most pervasive parts of our social policies in the country.
I understand that and from your information that's on your website, you talk more about it, about how your interest in Northwest Indiana issues got you involved in a very recent local race, and in particular, the race for a Gary mayor. And tell us more about how you ended up meeting Jerome Prince and how you got interested and involved in his campaign.
Sure. I actually met Jerome Prince on on just regular business. I was at the Crown Point Assessor's Office, and he was behind the front desk and stepped forward to help me with a problem I was having with a property tax bill on a property that I had used for a little bit as a vacation rental in Gary. And I was just very impressed with him then, had no idea that he'd be running for mayor, had no idea that we'd be working together in the future. And I was very impressed with him then. And then when I ran into him again after he announced that he was running for mayor, I just thought, this is who we need. This is the guy we need. Gary has so much potential and so many beautiful natural resources, and the people in Gary really want to help. We got involved when Jerome was elected, won the primary, we started putting together this Can We Talk forum, where he went out to every district in the city and listened to people and listened to what they wanted and what they thought. And there were no holds barred. You could say anything you wanted, and whatever you thought would improve your city, you were allowed to say. Well, we took that further and came up with this Reimagine Gary process, where we had over 100 people that volunteered on writing if you could say anything you want for Gary, what would it be if money were no object? What can you reimagine Gary to be? And the amount of enthusiasm and concern and the level of talent, and these are from volunteers who gave of their time because they care. And it was so rewarding to see how many people care and how deeply they care. And if we can harness that kind of volunteerism and that kind of spirit, there's nothing we can't do in this region.
Did you find it in these discussions that you had involved with Gary Mayer's campaign and the Reimagine Gary project that you just talked about? Do you think that these were projects and topics that you may have been aware of, but you thought that these have to be expanded on a whole district? Why? Because you're talking here about several counties, mm-hmm. which are within the first congressional district. And mm-hmm. if you run for Congress and you get elected, then those would be your responsibility to keep an eye on those.
True. And what I saw in the Reimagine Gary process that is translatable to the whole region is certainly the spirit of volunteerism and people who genuinely care and want to help. And if you put it in the climate change context, which is my number one issue, but it's also related to economic development, if we use emergency powers to bring federal resources to the region, we can develop a comprehensive plan for fighting climate change, and we can get every person in every county on board to look at their lands, do an assessment, do their own internal assessment. What lands are vacant? What lands are available for solar farms? Where can we put solar panels on rooftops? Where can we put wind? And let the local people come up with their own plan. And to draw out the grid and see where we have connectivity problems, if we can come together the way that we did in Gary, which I know that we can on a regional basis, we can come up with our own plan for fighting climate change that will also turn our economy around. Climate change will lead to what I've read, an estimate is 170,000 construction jobs in Indiana. And if we get a fourth of those, because we're right off the lake and we're better situated than some of the other counties, if we even get 50,000 new construction jobs, that will turn our economy around. And we do need to diversify our economy. So steel's been a great partner, and we need to continue with that partnership. But we also need more jobs, more paying jobs that people can use to support their families and not have to work two jobs to pay their bills.
One of the other projects that will come right through the region, and you're aware of, and actually through the city of Gary for that matter, too, is the expansion of the South Shore Railroad, in particular with the double-tracking project, which adds the extra tracks and, in turn, better capacity along the route between Gary and Michigan City, as well as the stretch over to the west part of Lake County, the Westlake Corridor, which would connect the lines there in Hammond South. Do you think that these are some of the areas in particular that you'd like to see, with the advantage of having federal funding, being able to pay for these projects, to get these projects going and build on this economic development that you want to do?
Absolutely. And the double track is an integral part of the economic development plan as well. I'd like to drive an economic revival that's based on greening our economy, which means diversifying our economy, laying more grids, upgrading our grids, evaluating fields for solar farms as well as turbines, and these will lead to ongoing well-paid jobs that have good benefits. The double track is an amazing opportunity. I take the South Shore quite a bit to go to work, and having that be faster and more reliable is a wonderful thing. It'll draw people from the region and from other areas to want to live in Northwest Indiana. We need to build our tax base. We are desperately in need of driving our tax base so that we can afford the programs and the services that we need. And greening the area is a great way to market the area. The millennials and the young people who care very deeply about climate, and I think all of us care about climate now, but they're very attracted to greening initiatives. And I think a great way to market not just Gary, but the whole Northwest Indiana would be to market ourselves as a climate forward economic revival. I think we could lead the country in this initiative. And certainly the double track is part of it, because then we have the ability to transport people who have to work in the city but who want to live in a more natural environment like Northwest Indiana. It's a wonderful tool.
Let's talk about health care, because we know that's one of the ongoing issues that has been brought up in Congress, certainly, and the federal government, but here in Northwest Indiana as well, too. What are your thoughts about trying to make sure that there's affordable health care for all Hoosiers, and in particular for residents of the 1st District?
Well, health care is something that is in everyone's mind. A lot of people can't afford their prescription. Because they're, you know, they've got out of pockets and they've got copays, and there's no cap on what the drug industry can charge for a lot of these drugs that we have to pay for out of our pocket. We need to fix that. I think it's appalling that you have to pay more for a certain drug in the United States than you would pay if you got it from India or Mexico. And it's just silly that we have big pharma prices that we can't afford, but you can get them if you go elsewhere. So prescription drug costs are a huge issue. Medicare for all, I know that there's a big debate on that right now. I would rather do my own numbers before I come out either strongly in favor or against it. I like to run my own numbers. My sense, though, is that we need to transition. We can't just get rid of private health care because some people like their private health care. And if we're going to have a single payer, we need to transition gradually. And I think Obamacare was wonderful in a lot of ways in getting rid of a health care plan to go into a new one that we haven't tried before, I think is a little premature. I think we need to have a gradual transference into single payer, but I think we need to keep the features of our health care system that work and improve the ones that don't, but not wholesale.
You mentioned at the start of a conversation about your involvement as an attorney in private practice and representing the Chicago Board of Education in the matters that you deal with in mm-hmm. Chicago. What are your thoughts here in particular about Northwest Indiana education, and if you're elected to Congress, what do you hope to be able to transfer not only here locally but as well bring back to Indiana from the federal government?
Right. Thank you. My perspective on education is probably unique because I've spent years litigating education law with teachers, the suits that are bought by teachers, the teachers' union, the Board of Education. And I've watched many acronyms like No Child Left Behind, ICLB, all of the different acronyms that have come through in the last 26 years. At the end of the day, we're not closing our education gap fast enough. My perspective on that is driven by my own home life. I had we had domestic violence and substance abuse in my home. And I believe that a lot of the problems with our education system, at least public education system, are behavior-based and are based on our failure to detect trauma. I can only base that on what I grew up with. It's very hard for a child that comes from that kind of a background to sit in class and think about French or algorithms or something that they're supposed to be doing. And it's not just the kids that are coming from the homes that are affected. Those kids are affecting your kids, are affecting everyone's kids, because you've got 20 children in a classroom. If you've got one or two kids that are acting up, they affect the scores of everybody in that room. And I've known teachers for years. I've got good friends who are teachers, and they tell me that they spend way too much time disciplining children than they should, and that they're eating into the instructional time. And they can see that one or two children in the classroom who need help, who need intervention, who need to be tested for trauma, they take away the attention of everyone in that classroom. And it's ongoing. It's chronic. And I believe that is a big part of what's driving our education gap, and that when we start evaluating these children and helping them, if you have one adult who's aware of what you're going through at home, that can be the lifeline you need to pull you up and to build your own internal resilience. And I believe that when we start being aware of trauma in the home, we can start helping these children. And I think the Indiana Board of Education is getting a lot of things right. I agree with fair funding for schools. I think that teachers should be paid commensurate with what other people are paid in the field of similar pay and background. We've got a 20% pay differential that we need to close. And becoming more aware of and testing for trauma in the home, I think will do way more to advance our test scores than anything anyone's ever talked about. out. So my focus is really on helping these children when they come in the door, diagnose them, help them, give them the social service they need, give them the hand up. And when we start fixing our behavior problems in the classroom, we're going to see our education scores get a lot better.
They talk about the problems the youngsters have in class, some of it stemming, unfortunately, from incidents at home or what they have grown up in life. That brings up the topic of mental health. And that's one of, I know one of the planks on your campaign is to deal with that. How do you hope to be able to address it and be able to translate it into what you could do if elected into Congress on the federal level?
Well, thank you. The mental health issue is, I think, bigger than most people are willing to admit. Certainly politicians don't like to talk about it because it's not pleasant. I believe that untreated mental health is at the root of some of our nation's worst problems, including gun violence. I described how I think it is leading to our education gap. I think it's trauma in the home. And it doesn't have to just be the home. If it's not going on in your house and you see it out on the street corner, kids who have to see violence every day, they suffer. Children are impressionable. They suffer. They close down. They get hardened. They act up in class because they don't know how to process. They're not emotionally equipped to process the violence that they're seeing either at home or on their street. Could be gang violence, could be just neighborhood violence, could be anything. But we need to start being sensitive to that. And when we start assessing children coming in the door, that mental health assistance should permeate their lives, beginning with school, and then as they get out. I think in Indiana, they're trying to have mental health services from the beginning through 22 years old, because, you know, it doesn't stop when you turn 18 either. But mental health treatment, if we start funding our mental health services and doing more assessments for students, for everyone, certainly before you get a gun, I think mental health can be used to improve everything that we're trying to deal with in our domestic situation, including gun violence and education and crime.
We only have a little time left in this conversation, at least, and we can bring this up in the future to be sure. But let's touch on a few other things that you would have to deal with as a member of Congress if elected. The issue of defending democracy, what are your concerns there that you'd like to translate into action for Northwest Indiana from in Washington?
I am very alarmed by what's going on now. I am concerned about the partisan bickering on both sides, but I feel very strongly that if we are not careful in preserving our separation of powers, we could lose it. It took hundreds of years for the people who wrote the Constitution to get to that point. I mean, you go all the way back 500 years to talk about individual liberties. It's more than a notion. Our liberties, our First Amendment is under attack. Our civil liberties are under attack. Separation of powers. I don't even know if there is such a thing. If one branch of government can completely ignore a subpoena and enlist the assistance of a foreign power and can ask for a personal favor in exchange for $350 million in military aid, if that's not impeachable, I don't know what is. I don't like all the time that we have to spend and all the money that we've had to spend on this, but our system matters. It's not just an academic discussion. We have to have separation of powers, or our entire system of government will crumble. We have to preserve our democracy. I feel very, very strongly about it. I've litigated constitutional law issues. I've been published on constitutional law. It's a very big deal to me, and it matters very deeply.
And on the subject of immigration, that's a topic here in Northwest Indiana that we're all very concerned about.
Right. On immigration, so my concern with immigration is putting people in cages is terrible. I can't believe we're seeing this. I can't believe we live in a day and age where we're rounding people up and putting them in cages. I don't agree with doing raids, factory raids of completely peaceful people. We need migrant workers in some of our farming communities. But at the same time, we need strong borders. We have to be very careful with patrolling our borders. We can't have open borders. I don't know anyone who's claiming that we should have open borders. It's been mischaracterized frequently, but we have to have strong borders. But ICE should be using their resources to go out and figure and find drug cartels and human trafficking. That's what they're supposed to be doing. They're not supposed to be out arresting innocent people who are working in factories and then taking them away so that the kids come home to an empty house at night. That's a complete distortion of what their mission is supposed to be, and I believe it's a waste of our resources.
We've run out of time in this conversation. Okay. We appreciate you spending time introducing yourself and talking about these issues for this time around, and we hope to have you back again very soon to talk about some of the other issues that you want to bring up to residents in Northwest Indiana while you're campaigning.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris. I hope that over the next 20 weeks, I will work to earn your support, your prayers, and on May 5th, your vote to send me to Congress. And thank you so much.
You're welcome. Sabrina Hake is one of the candidates who's running in the Democratic Party primary election next May to run for 1st Congressional District, seat that Pete Visklosky has held for many, many years and has decided not to run for re-election. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. With another edition of Building Northwest Indiana, here's Kevin Comerford.
Welcome to another episode of Building Northwest Indiana Radio. My name is Kevin Comerford. I am the Director of Professional Development at the Construction Advancement Foundation of Northwest Indiana, and I will be your host today. The purpose of Building Northwest Indiana Radio is to give you a little insight into the Northwest Indiana professional construction industry. Today we will be talking about the Klein Avenue Bridge, which is located on Indiana State Road 912 in East Chicago, Indiana. My guest today is Terry Velligan and Laura Weber. Terry is the general manager for Klein Avenue Bridge, LLC, and Laura is the communication specialist for the Klein Avenue Bridge. Terry and Laura, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us, Kevin.
Hi, Kevin. Thank you.
I used to work out at BP, and I remember back in 2009 when the road kind of, I think, NDOT shut down the bridge just because of structural damage, and then I was really inconvenienced for a while. But I'm glad to hear that they're putting a bridge back up, and I guess that's kind of what you guys are doing. You guys are putting up this bridge right on Klein Avenue. Can you talk a little bit maybe about the history of the closure and how you guys came to becoming involved in this project?
Sure, Kevin. Like you said, NDOT put it up back in 1982, 83, then it fell down. They rebuilt it, started in 2006, 2007, and took it down shortly after that. It's been essentially down for 10 years. So our company, United Bridge Partners, Klein Avenue Bridge, LLC, came in and acquired the asset from NDOT. A lot of people have been inconvenienced in the last 10 years not having that extension or bridge because, obviously, working at BP, ArcelorMittal, U.S. Steel, not only that, but a lot of people from Chicago or from Northwest Indiana, they couldn't really have a direct route to Chicago. So our idea was to acquire this asset. It's a great asset. It helps relieve congestion in the area. And when we rebuilt it, it'll be another straight shot, essentially, to Chicago. And we actually call it the Gateway of Lake County for a number of reasons.
Is there a reason why NDOT didn't want the asset back?
I don't know exact reason.
Yeah.
I mean, I was in different areas at the time. But what I heard or read in the newspapers is that NDOT or the state of Indiana didn't seem that it was needed anymore.
Okay.
I think part of it was financial. It costs a lot of money to rebuild that. I think that that's probably the two high points why they didn't rebuild it.
Okay, let's switch directions here and let's talk actually about the bridge project. I guess, how is the bridge funded currently? And can you talk about the construction of the bridge itself, the piers, the actual bridge deck?
Our project is funded through a private investment. So it's 100% privately funded. There are no federal, state, local dollars used in the project. The construction of the bridge piers, those were put down first. They're founded on a series of 16-inch diameter steel piles. Each of the 29 piers has approximately 16 different piles, and then they were cast in place, so those were completed first. If you drive along that area, you can see all 29 of them are currently up.
This bridge spans the Indiana Harbor Canal. Are any of the piers actually built into the water, or are they both on shore? Or how does it span over the water?
That's a good question. There are two essentially footings in the water behind the bumpers. So we actually looked at that when we were looking at acquiring the asset and saw that those were structurally sound.
So you were able to reuse the footings for the piers?
Yeah, we were able to reuse the footings and we built off the existing footings. So right now it's essentially Pier 17 and 18 mm-hmm. in the canal. And then we were able to build off those.
That canal has to allow pretty high cargo to come through the area. How high is the bridge set off from the level of the channel?
So the clearance is actually the same as the previous bridge.
Okay.
It's a 100-foot vertical clearance. Due to Coast Guard regulations, they kept it the same due to the ships coming in and out of that canal. 100 feet clearance.
Wow.
One of the things I want to add, a lot of people ask, you know, in looking at the finances of building the bridge, I'm sure we're going to get to that in a little bit, but, you know, if you build a bridge at grade level,
mm-hmm.
probably the cost of that structure goes down. We weren't able to do that in terms of we weren't able to go lower because there's still ships that go through that. So that's really the height of 100-foot clearance is mandated by the United States Coast Guard.
I read an article, I think it was last week, about the construction of the bridge segments itself. So this bridge is being constructed kind of on site, but not in place.
So it's on the site. How large is the facility?
We actually built what we call a casting building. Mm-hmm. The building is 24,600 feet. Let's just call it 25,000 square feet.
Well, that's pretty large. You have a company that is used to casting concrete in place that are operating this, or is it entirely Klein Avenue Bridge LLC that's doing these operations?
Yes, we have the company that we're working with who is actually doing the physical production of it. So the production of that wrapped up a few weeks ago. There's a series of three casting beds in this facility, which is on our property. We can look out our office windows and it's right there. So it's great that by using those three beds, they were able to produce three segments per day thereabout. And they would take each segment when it was finished, move it to the side, and then they would cast the next one through a process called match casting. So they would make sure that every single segment was an exact fit to where it needed to fit within the location of the bridge.
That will do it for today's edition of Building Northwest Indiana Radio. I would like to thank our guests, Terry Velligan and Laura Weber with the Klein Avenue Bridge LLC. To find out more information about the Klein Avenue Bridge, please visit kleinav.com.
And tune in next week for part two of this discussion here on Regionally Speaking. Support for Building Northwest Indiana is brought to you by the Construction Advancement Foundation. You can hear Building Northwest Indiana right here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM every Tuesday. And the podcasts are also available online at lakeshorepublicradio.org. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
Something really important to offer in terms of fascinating the area that we
You can find more regional stories online at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. This is Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. We have topics involving recycling here to bring up. First, it's about Porter County's recycling program. In particular, with the Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction District, we have with us Ron Taylor, who's the Public Education Coordinator, and Carrie Mars Barone, who is the new Executive Director of the Porter County program. And thank you both for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Great to be here.
Well,
thanks, Chris.
First, I guess let's talk a little bit here about, how things are coming along with the drop-off recycling program in Porter County. It's had its shares of ups and downs, and you've had to make some changes lately. Let's get into the changes first and let people know where they can recycle, and then, of course, what they can recycle, which is also very, very important, too.
Recently, we had to relocate our Valparaiso drop-off recycling site, and that was the one located at Strachan Van Til on US 30. Our contract ended with that particular property, and so we had to be relocated to our Valparaiso compost site at 2150 West Lincoln Way, Valparaiso, Indiana. And so we appreciate that that can be a little less convenient for some people, but we are working to locate a more permanent location in the long term. It's a very involved and difficult process. We need something like 250 feet of open space in order to actually house and situate the containers. So it's very difficult to locate property that meets those needs. But we are still committed to drop off recycling in Valparaiso and making it as easy as humanly possible for people to recycle.
Now, from our listeners that maybe are familiar with the drop-off sites, but maybe don't recall exactly what you can bring there, refresh our memories as to what, and in particular, this relocated Valparaiso drop-off recycling site, what can you take in at that site?
Well, it's actually very exciting, Chris, because it's at our current compost location, which houses a lot of different avenues. So in the typical recycling bins, you can put in your mixed recycles, the plastics, not plastic bags or plastic wraps, but
right.
You have your plastic, you have your cardboard, all those Christmas presents that are coming, the wrapping paper, your typical recycling items that you might put in a curbside bin. But yet, since this is at our compost site, it also allows for people to drop off still some leaves, their brush, Christmas trees. We also have our electronic site there. So if you have an old computer, you have your old electronics, you can drop those, batteries. One thing I just recently learned is that you can take non-working Christmas lights. So if even with the bulbs in them, you can go ahead and bring those up and drop them off in the electronic site.
That's great.
Batteries from leftover toys and remote controls that do not work, the battery drop-off is also right within the electronic site. So computer chargers, cell phone chargers, those that have a battery charge can be recycled as well.
Now, have you had to relocate any of the other recycling drop-off sites around Porter County lately, or is this the first one and maybe hopefully will be the only one that you have to relocate?
At this time, this will be the only one we have to relocate.
Mm-hmm.
Our contract ended with the current location, and they have future plans for their building, I believe.
There's a great exhaustive list of everything that can and can't be recycled on PorterCountyRecycling.org. That has a breakdown of all the different sites, exactly where they are, what can and can't be taken. There are some complexities to some things. Our motto is kind of when in doubt, throw it out. It's very, very important to reduce contamination, to make sure things that don't belong in the recycling aren't going into the recycling. That causes tremendous problems. It's very important that the industry runs smoothly so that we can still continue to offer these recycling programs to our residents. So, recycling, PorterCountyRecycling.org, great exhaustive list, everything you can and can't take to all the different sites. So that's a really helpful resource we hope people will use.
I know that in this year that's coming to an end, or 2019, that's been one of the major problems that Porter County Recycling and Waste Production District, along with a lot of others, not just in Porter County, but all across not only Northwest Indiana, but the rest of the country, is dealing with our problems with contamination and recyclables, and in particular with the recycling markets. If you will, both of you, please bring us up to date on the situation involving the problems that you all and other solid waste management districts and other recycling groups face in trying to deal with the lack of markets that are out there.
Well, unfortunately, actually on an international scale, there were some international buyers of American recycled plastics. I believe plastics is primarily the sticking point, but certain companies in other countries have stopped taking recycling for the United States. So unfortunately, that makes it less economically viable for some of the companies that do the processing and actually do the selling. And that's kind of that's what keeps the entire process running smoothly, is when you have companies that will actually purchase the recyclables and then churn them into new items. So one of the biggest issues is that other countries, China being the primary one, would take American recyclable recycled plastics. They tolerated a certain level of contamination, and unfortunately, that's what's making it less and less economically viable. When you have a lot of contamination, it stops up the machines, it gums up the works of the process, so that makes it less profitable for companies to actually engage in the recycling. So that's why now more than ever, it's really, really important to reduce the contamination, because that's what makes it profitable to actually sell these materials that can be recycled.
Have you folks in Porter County run into problems with other types of recyclables, or has it primarily been in the plastics that you bring in from the drop-off sites, and maybe even to a certain point from the curbside recycling pickups too? Is it only plastics, or are you finding problems with contamination in paper and some of the other recyclables?
Yeah, I mean, contamination can be an issue with pretty much anything, pizza boxes, things like that. When you have, when you have cheese in the pizza box, that into the paper cardboard recycling, that's a problem as well. Plastics present a certain problems all on their own. There are many different kinds of plastics. Some of them can only be recycled a certain way. So it's a little bit more of a more difficult line to walk as far as contamination when it comes to plastics, and plastics are so durable in the environment. They last so long when they get into the oceans. They're around forever. They break up into microplastics, so they cause so many more environmental problems, and that's why really getting that process as smooth as possible can be really extra important with regards to plastic. But contamination is an issue with any kind of recyclable, so that's why we're really really trying to push the message that people need to recycle responsibly and accurately.
Carrie, I know, Carrie, you're the new executive director for the Porter County Recycling and Waste Production District. You have a chance to get out and talk with folks and organizations in Porter County. You have to kind of preach to them to be sure to let their folks know and other residents know that you have to be sure to keep them clean, no contamination.
We try to send out lots of messages. We try to be in contact. We're usually at every meeting or event, we're sharing our list that encourages people how to recycle right, and the things that you can recycle. We're really proud here at Porter County. There's a lot of things that we do recycle. The smoke detector program, we have the batteries and the fluorescent tubes. There are so many locations throughout the county that, several of the hardware stores allow those battery drop-off locations everywhere you go. So we're super proud of that. Another thing to note, though, is to remember to recycle right, and also think about how we can reuse the things we currently have. Right now we're in a society where bottled water is very popular, and we buy a lot of throwaway items, if you'd like to think of it. But yet, could we do something where you use your same, you carry your refillable water bottle, or you carry your refillable coffee mug, so that we can reduce the number of papers and plastics. Some of the information and some of the things become contaminated. For instance, a full water bottle in a recycle bin can contaminate the rest of the recycle bin just because there's liquid present. So little things like that.
I know that you've mentioned this earlier in our conversation, but it bears repeating again that, of course, we're getting close to Christmas Day and Christmas trees. A lot of people are buying real live Christmas trees. Well, they won't live forever, as we know, but they'll be out there, I guess, to be dropped off for composting and the like. Once again, where can folks bring their discarded Christmas trees when the time comes that they have to take them down? And what do they need to do about all the ornaments and stuff that they normally would put on them?
Well, obviously, you're going to need to remove the ornaments and the Christmas tree lights. But knowing that now this year our drop-off recycling location has been moved to our compost site, we feel very blessed that our compost site will actually be open. Usually it closes for the season this past weekend, but now it is actually opened. It'll be open 6 days a week from 8 to 4. So if you have your Christmas tree, you have your Christmas tree lights that are not working and you have your recycles, you can head up to the compost site at 2150 West Lincoln Way in Valparaiso. The hours for the winter will be Monday through Saturday, 8 to 4. Now, we do have a couple extended hours because of the holiday. We will actually be open on Sunday, December 22nd, and Sunday, December 29th for people to bring in their cardboard, their presents, their gift wrap. We will be closed for the Christmas Day holiday as well as the New Year's Day holiday, January 1st.
Now, Ron, I'll give you the last word here because we only have a couple minutes left here. But, of course, looking to 2020, it's never too early to think about Earth Day, is it? And especially the celebration that, a big celebration that Porter County puts on. Tell us more about what's planned for next year.
April 18th, Northwest Indiana Earth Day celebration. We're really looking forward to putting on our biggest event yet. Unfortunately, the Porter County Expo Center was being renovated last year, so we were not able to host Earth Day. So now at the newly renovated Expo Center, we're looking forward to hosting our most spectacular event yet. It's going to include activities, entertainment. We're going to have silly safaris there, dumpster drummers, environmentally themed entertainment, vendors. So it's a really, really exciting event for us, and we're hoping everybody can turn out for it.
Well, it sounds like it'll be another great event going on into 2020 for celebrating Earth Day. And just to remind people, it's important to pay attention not only to what you put in the recycling bin and put over onto the compost pile as well at the drop-off site, but important, I guess, to educate others and to the importance of properly recycling. And once again, Carrie and Ron, give us the website address so people can find out more not only about the events coming up here, but also as well about the proper way to recycle in Porter County.
PorterCountyRecycling.org is our website, and our Facebook page is facebook.com/recycleportercounty. And those are both great ways to get updates about the newest programs, any new news and information, any changes, any service information. We really, really are very active on both those channels, and we hope people will follow us and like us and really help us get the word out about everything we do here.
Well, Ron and Carrie, thank you very much for being with us to talk about the importance of properly recycling in Porter County, and I hope to have you back on regionally speaking again soon.
Thanks for having us, Chris. We look forward to it.
Ron Taylor is the Public Education Coordinator, and Carrie Mars Marone is the Executive Director of the Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction District. Many veterans come out of military service to make homes back wherever you happen to live, particularly here in Northwest Indiana. But sometimes if a veteran is coming back with some life-altering disabilities, it may mean some real challenges in trying to get accustomed to the job market these days. And there have been some changes that the Department of Veterans Affairs has made that will help veterans getting out of service and getting back into civilian life that happen to have disabilities. And to find out more about the changes in the program, it's been around for a while, but some very serious and very technological upgrades, we have William Streiberger. He is the Executive Director of Vocational Rehabilitation and Employment Service with the Veterans Benefits Administration, which is part of the Department of Veterans Affairs. And we thank you very much for being with us today, sir.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Well, some of these programs I know that, of course, been around since the VA has basically taken advantage of the GI Bill, was set up by Congress many, many decades ago, have had some upgrades because things have changed. And tell us first, if you will, the situation, how it's differed from past decades with now the more newer, I guess, arenas of conflict and what the veterans coming out of those conflicts are facing these days.
We're really excited today to share with your listeners about the Vocational Rehabilitation and Employment Program. This program serves veterans with disabilities who have obstacles to obtaining employment because of those illnesses, injuries, or disabling factors, achieve suitable employment opportunities through education, training, and advanced employment services. Today is quite different from the past because we're upgrading our systems and using technology. Before we started, we talked about the traffic a little bit in Chicago, and we know that that can be a barrier to veterans even coming in and getting an appointment with a counselor. So we've implemented the new VA Video Connect technology that enables us to have Skype or FaceTime-like interviewing capabilities through the use of technology that assists veterans with busy lives avoid the time and cost of coming in for an appointment.
Are you finding that with the new technology that it's easier to help veterans prepare not only for getting the right resume put together for the skills and the abilities that they have, but also to go out there and look for something that will fit what they can do?
Absolutely. Technology is a basis for all of the modern job preparation and job search skills, and we're continuing to develop our opportunities to provide that same type of technology that all veterans experience in their private sector lives. So we're looking at how we can enhance the ease of access to our program and participation in the program through job readiness and job development opportunities using technology.
When you talk about looking not only to be able to set up good resumes for veterans that are coming in into the workforce again after being away on duty, and they have to have the right kind of training and all, what kind of opportunities can you put up for these veterans that have this extra special problem to deal with and to be able to get them trained for the right kind of job?
So we work with veterans in a very individualized fashion. Each veteran presents their own different circumstances that might be barriers to employment. So they work with one of our 900 vocational rehabilitation counselors across the nation to conduct what's called an evaluation and planning session, which assesses their interests, aptitudes, and abilities for different careers or vocations, and then prescribes a plan of services, which could include technical training, a college education, or other preparations and certifications to fully prepare them to be successful. So this is very individualized. Every veteran gets a unique opportunity to ensure that that plan of service doesn't impact their disabilities or is going to impede them in any way from being successful in their new employment goals and objectives.
Now, you mentioned about all of the technology that's been put into place here to make things easier for veterans that have some disabilities to be able to prepare themselves for life outside of the military. How long has it taken you and your colleagues there with the Department of Veterans Affairs to be ready to be able to roll this out?
So this is a three-year process of modernizing the Vocational Rehabilitation and Employment Program. We're at the halfway mark. So we've done some really terrific things, not only in terms of technology, but some people processes too. We've been supported by legislation to increase the number of vocational rehabilitation counselors across the nation to ensure that our caseloads, so when a veteran is engaging with a vocational rehabilitation counselor, they're one of a few veterans and not many or more than a counselor can handle. So they get the specialized treatment, and that counselor is available to them when they need them so that they can continue in their program.
I know you mentioned about the ease in helping it make it available for veterans to be able to easily get help because maybe if they happen to be here, say, in Northwest Indiana, they would have to go to the Jesse Brown VA Medical Center in Chicago. And with the traffic being as it is and all, what kind of new technology? You mentioned briefly about the Video Connect. Are there any other bits of new technology that are out there or will be in use for veterans that have disabilities to be able to be in touch with the counselors as well as even with the medical crews they may have to work with?
Sure, and I would like to just point out, and we thank the Veterans Health Administration for leading the way on telehealth because they originated this technology that we're using in the counseling space. So veterans who are listening can ask, in certain instances, their medical providers to provide those medical appointments using the same technology we're using for counseling. So that's a really good approach. The second thing that I want to point out, Chris, is that we're using artificial intelligence, which is widely used in everyday living from banking to hospitality to doctors and medical care within the VR&E space so that we can provide veterans with opportunities to schedule and reschedule appointments using artificial intelligence, what we call EVA, the electronic virtual assistant. They can manage their case with their counselor through the use of this technology, which is available on their smartphone devices and their computers, so it minimizes the back and forth of engaging with a counselor that often takes place with missed phone calls, return voicemails, and multiple emails. So we're trying to reduce any stress on the veteran in this process so that they can focus on what they really need to be doing, and that is pursuing a training program or some type of certification, as well as their health care to make sure they remain healthy and able to participate in their program while they're with us.
Now, did you all have an opportunity to be able to kind of do a test run, a beta, so to speak, to get this ready before doing the full rollout?
Absolutely. We piloted the new technology with a few stations early on across the country. It's been fully deployed since last November. We've had about 20,000 appointments using VA Video Connect, and that continues to grow every month as veterans become more comfortable and open to having a counseling appointment with their counselor using this type of technology. So we see more opportunity where we'll continue to grow this. As we go through this change process, you know, change is somewhat hard at times, both on the veteran side of the house and our employees. So as we get used to it and more comfortable in using technology to engage with one another on a veteran's success, mm-hmm. we're seeing more adaptation of this and more use of it in our program.
Now, if we just get down to the availability, if people are interested, if veterans or their family members are finding out about this in our conversation, how can they get more information and get signed up if they aren't already?
Absolutely. They can go on our website, va.gov, and click on Vocational Rehabilitation and Employment. They can apply online there, find out more information about our program of services, or they can call one of our representatives and speak to them live at 1-800-827-1000. And our representatives will get them hooked up with the office closest to them so that they can be in touch with a vocational rehabilitation counselor and pursue the program.
Well, Mr. Schreiberger, thank you very much for the information and the best of luck in continuing the work and rolling this out and this brand new program using the best technology to help veterans that need the help the most. We thank you for talking about it today.
Thank you so much, Chris.
William Schreiberger is the Executive Director of Vocational Rehabilitation and Employment Service, Veterans Benefits Administration, with the Department of Veterans Affairs. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. Hope you'll join us tomorrow.